Chinese health officials say the number of new cases of the coronavirus has slowed for the third consecutive day. The health commission confirms over 1,800 new cases Sunday and 142 deaths. Reuters' Adam Reed has more.
The coronavirus has presented Beijing with the huge challenge of stamping out the epidemic whilst also preventing damage to the world's second largest economy. But on Sunday, China's National Health Commission said a campaign to prevent and control the disease was showing results. China has placed Hubei province and its capital Wuhan, where the outbreak is believed to have originated, under virtual lockdown. Spokesman Mi Fang said the medical support and preventative measures in Hubei had headed off more critical cases and that mild cases were being treated more quickly to prevent them from becoming critical.
That's Reuters' Adam Reed. In Japan, the cruise ship Diamond Princess remains under quarantine. Several hundred Americans are evacuating aboard charter flights. Deborah Pagan tells Hawaii News Now Americans on board were pressured to return to the U.S.
When we got that email yesterday, it did sound like, you know, make your decision or else. That's how I took it, because the capital letters that they had on that letter was, if you decide not to take the charter flight, we don't know what your future holds, but you will not be able to enter the U.S.
More than 350 cases of the coronavirus have been diagnosed on the ship. Several rockets have hit a base in Iraq's capital that hosts a U.S.-led military coalition. A coalition spokesman says no one was injured in the attack early Sunday in Baghdad's Green Zone. The attack is the latest in a recent string of attacks targeting coalition troops. For more on today's news, please go to voanews.com. You're listening to VOA News. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says his country will never hold talks with the United States under pressure, adding that the Islamic Republic will one day force its enemy to come to the negotiating table. The U.S. has reimposed crippling economic sanctions on Iran after exiting a major nuclear deal in 2018. Yemen's Houthi movement says retaliatory airstrikes after the shooting down of a Saudi-led coalition warplane have killed civilians, including children. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
The United Nations says as many as 31 Yemeni civilians died in airstrikes on Saturday that the country's Houthi movement claims were retaliation by a Saudi-led coalition. In the latest flare-up in the five-year Yemen conflict, the Iran-aligned Houthis claimed on Friday to have shot down a coalition Tornado warplane in the Houthi-controlled Al-Jawf province. The area's health ministry said women and children were among those killed in the subsequent coalition airstrikes. The UN office in Yemen said preliminary field reports indicated 12 injured, as well as the up to 31 civilians killed.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres began a three-day visit to Pakistan by urging the international community to support countries that continue to host millions of refugees from Afghanistan. Guterres is in Islamabad for meetings with Pakistani leaders and to deliver a keynote address to an international conference. The Democratic presidential hopefuls are campaigning in Nevada this weekend. Senator Amy Klobuchar is riding a wave of momentum after finishing third in the New Hampshire primary. Appearing on ABC's This Week, she says her campaign is on an upswing.
We see ourselves on an upward path. I never thought I was going to be able to compete with some of my opponents' bank accounts. But what I don't have in that, I have made up in hard work. We've got teams now in every Super Tuesday state. And we actually, since the New Hampshire debate, in just nearly over a week, raised $12 million.
Appearing on the same program, billionaire philanthropist Tom Steyer says he's building a strong coalition.
If I can show there that I can put together that coalition and take that with momentum into Super Tuesday with the kind of diverse coalition that I believe I'm building and that I believe I will show, then that will give me the momentum and people will have to look at me as a serious candidate, because the real question here is, who can beat Donald Trump?
Nevada's caucuses are the next chance for voters to choose a candidate to represent them in the November election against President Donald Trump. Firefight Australia held a huge concert in Sydney on Sunday with local and international artists performing. It was a great event attended by over 70,000 people. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
When there are more than the number of accredited voters, the law stipulates on something, and that is not to go ahead and declare somebody the winner. So it is clear before them, and it is now being brought to their notice.
The Nigerian Supreme Court plans to hear a petition seeking to restore former Imo State Governor Tuesday.
The president is conflicted. As long as he becomes the presidential candidate, he becomes conflicted. So I believe that parliament will do the right thing to make sure that the chairperson of the commission is not appointed by the president, so that we are all put on equal footing.
The Malawian main opposition party begins preparations ahead of the presidential election rerun.
It's only the PF that continues mobilizing their party throughout the year. The opposition has refused permits to hold even public rallies or even indoor meetings. So what is happening in Zambia needs a lot of intervention from UN, African Union, and of course SADC.
And two Zambian opposition parties team up to challenge the outcome of the Chilubi by-election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLM-IO, says it will not be part of a transitional government if issues surrounding the security arrangement are not resolved. Pok Both Balwang, Director for Information and Public Relations for the SPLM-IO, however, says his group is not seeking for the re-extension of the pre-transitional period aimed to help resolve all issues ahead of the implementation of the peace agreement. Meanwhile, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has sacked governors of the 32 states late Saturday. For more reactions to the president's action, I reach Pok Both Balwang, Director for Information and Public Relations for the SPLM-IO.
The SPLM-IO welcome and appreciate the bold decision taken by President Salva Kiir by reaffirming the agreed number of the state between Dr. Riek Machar and him. However, we have a concern regarding the decision made by President Salva Kiir, which is the establishment of the three new administrative area.
Why do you have a concern about that?
Well, first of all, these three administrative areas, they were not part, or they're not among the root causes in South Sudan. This is one. Two, the resolution of that meeting, of the resolution of President Salva Kiir, he has stated that the country will revert back to 10 states with the relevant former counties. Bruin County is a county in Unity State. Abiyamnom County is a county in Unity State. Now, why now making it an administrative area?
So, Paul, where does this leave the resolution of the other outstanding issues before the formation of a transitional government? Or, as you said, with this concern, that could undermine efforts to form a transitional government in the next few days?
Well, we still have another issue, which is the security arrangement. We believe that the security arrangement is the core or the backbone of the agreement itself. Without it implemented fully, it would be very risky forming the government without a proper security arrangement, because it would be like riding a time machine going back to 2016 when we formed the government without a proper security arrangement and without resolving the issue of the state. So this issue was discussed in the tripartite consultation in Addis Ababa, but the decision on this issue was deferred to the next or the forthcoming meeting. But unfortunately, the meeting is supposed to take place, but the IGAD has changed their schedule from today, and they will say that this issue will be discussed in Juba as part of the IGAD head of state extraordinary summit in the coming days. So we still have a concern, because to us we have proposed that the UNMISS forces can take the responsibility of the security in the major towns and civilian centers and the last line routes. This is a proposal that we have come up as an SPLAI, also that we can expedite the process of the implementation of the security arrangement, so that the national government could be formed as soon as possible.
The pre-transitional period was extended for 100 days, which is expected to elapse in the next few days. What happens to it, and do you think a transitional government will be formed within the next few days, or do you think there will be a possible extension to allow for all these concerns you have to be resolved before the formation of a transitional government?
You know, during the meeting that held in Juba, the SPLM-SPLAIO has submitted a proposal to President Salsa and to the peace envoy on how we can move forward so that the government will be formed on time. The SPLM-SPLAIO is seeking that the government will be formed on time, but we have to implement or resolve the outstanding issues. Now, we came halfway regarding the issue of the state, and it has only one concern, which is the new administrative area that we want them be reducted or to just to be easily deleted by President Salva Kiir. But we still have this issue of the state. To us, the issue of the transition of the security arrangement. To us, we cannot form the government without the proper security arrangement. So this issue of the formation of the government, I think it has to be tabled in the next IGAD extraordinary meeting, so that we come up with a resolution. But we as an SPLM-SPLAIO, we are not calling for more extension, but we're calling for implementation or resolving of the outstanding issues so that we can move forward and form the government on time.
Pok Both Baluang is the Director for Information and Public Relations for the SPLM-IO. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Nigeria judges from the Supreme Court will begin hearing a petition Tuesday filed by Emeka Ehedioha, former Imo State governor. It asks the judges to set aside a previous judgment which removed him from office. Emeka Opara, lawyer for the former governor, says the previous judgment appears to be an overreach of the court. For more about the upcoming hearing of the petition calling on the court to reverse its decision, I reach Emeka Opara, lawyer for the deposed Imo State governor, Emeka Ehedioha.
The applicant, who is Emeka Ehedioha, wants the whole judgment set aside, and there are five grounds upon which the application is brought. If the court finds any one of those grounds proven, any such ground is sufficient to warrant a setting aside of that judgment. And these grounds range from the court not having adverted its mind and therefore not having ruled on an existing judgment of the Court of Appeal in an earlier case, vacating, totally setting aside the petition that warranted this judgment now in the Supreme Court. And what it means is that without having set aside the judgment of the Court of Appeal in that court appeal, the Supreme Court engaging in this judgment now is like deciding on a case that no longer exists.
Can you explain the grounds that you think is solid enough to enable the judges to reverse or set aside their previous judgment?
This particular ground I'm telling you about, and that is the number one ground, even if we leave the issue of fraud, the issue of misrepresentation and all that, and this particular ground is so strong and so fundamental to, it goes to the root of the jurisdiction of the court. It goes to the root of, say, hearing. Because you cannot actually decide a matter without hearing the parties on that matter and making a decision on it. So if the court finds so that what is alleged there exists, and of course that is something that just about looking into the records, if the court finds so, which I believe it should, there won't even be any need to go into the other ground. that alone should be able to make the court set aside that judgment. It's just a matter of law. The court is populated by great men and women of the law, eminent jurists, and I believe that they will do the right thing.
But is there a precedent where the Supreme Court has ruled or made a judgment and then reversed that decision? People are questioning whether that could happen.
It exists. Well, there are, you know, it's not a thing any Supreme Court engages in as a matter of, you know, something coming up always. But it happens. And in fact, in the briefs now before them, some of them have been pointed out to the court. Some of these judgments and orders, there have been. And in fact, there is one that is an electoral matter where the court set aside an earlier order, you know, of and substituted another one. It's a more serious matter, and it's before the court, I believe.
The decision was reached by the judges on the grounds that the results from 288 polling units were excluded when INEC announced the final result of the poll in 2019. How do you intend to challenge this or explain this to the advantage of your client, which you think the judges will agree to?
Well, that issue has come up on the issue of fraud and misrepresentation. Now, when the mind of the court was not adverted to the obvious fraud that existed there. Apart from that, you know, the fact of the issue of fraud, the court somehow did an overreach. And that was because under our Electoral Act, when the number of votes cast from the records, when they supersede, or rather, when they are more than the number of accredited voters, the law stipulates on something, and that is not to go ahead and declare somebody the winner. So it is clear before them, and it is now being brought to their notice.
Emeka Opara is the lawyer for the deposed Imo State Governor Emeka Ehedioha. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. At least 35 civilians have reportedly been killed and 40 homes torched in less than a week in the Cameroonian English-speaking Northwest region. This following bloody clashes between government troops and separatists fighting for the creation of an independent English-speaking state to be called Ambazonia. Both the rebels and the government blame each other for the gruesome murder of civilians, including children trapped in their burning homes. For VOA, Moki Ebere-Kezeka reports that affected relatives and communities that have escaped to the French-speaking capital Yaoundé are trying to deal with the situation.
Cameroonians from Donga Mantum, an administrative unit in the English-speaking Northwest region in Yaoundé, are trying to come to terms with news about massacres in their villages. Among them is 38-year-old Brununge, who says his wife's older sister's entire family of nine was killed in an attack in the village of Ngarbu Friday.
These people are taking refuge in Ngarbu, thinking that they were going to be safe in such a place, but they never knew that they would be killed in their sleep by the very military that is supposed to protect them. I think it is time for the international community to put pressure on the Cameroon government to find a quick settlement to this conflict that has claimed so many lives.
Ndonga Mantung's Roman Catholic, Baptist and Presbyterian churches decried the killing in services Sunday, saying at least 29 civilians, including children and a pregnant woman, were killed and 14 houses were torched in the fighting. Like Nge, they all said it was the military that was responsible for the killings. The military said many people were killed in raids but gave no further details. Local media reported that at least 35 civilians were killed in the crossfire between separatist fighters and the military or burned when their houses were torched. Separatist leader Samuel Ikome Sako, who calls himself interim president of Ambazonia, the English-speaking republic the separatists want to create, says the civilians were killed and their houses torched by Cameroon troops he describes as occupational forces dispatched by the French-speaking government in Yaoundé to keep the English-speaking part of the country under their grip. In a message shared on social media platforms, Sarko describes the killings as a massacre. He says his fighters have counted at least 40 civilian corpses in less than a week.
This is wickedness. These people now are walking into houses, burn as many, then select families, pull them out, shoot 22 in Dongamanto, 19 in Bui, many more in Gopitunja. We are losing hundreds per day.
Similar attacks were reported in several villages of the Bui, Ngokitunja and Mezam administrative units in the English-speaking Northwest and Lebelem and Manyu administrative units in the English-speaking Southwest. Cameroon said in January it had deployed at least 1,000 additional troops to the crisis-prone English-speaking regions prior to the February 9 local council and parliamentary elections separatist fighters have vowed to disrupt. Since the troop reinforcement, there have been several attacks on suspected separatist strongholds. Cameroon's Defense Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General René-Claude Meka, speaking on state media CRTV, denied his troops were responsible for the atrocities. He says the military has remained professional and blames separatists for the atrocities.
Nous sommes là pour défendre l'intégrité territoriale de notre pays.
Meka says everyone should know that the military is out to defend Cameroon's territorial integrity and its population from terrorists. He says in this very difficult moment, the military needs collaboration from the population to effectively defend civilians. He says anyone who has information that can be of help in fighting the terrorists should not hesitate to inform the military that is out to protect people and their property. In its 2020 World Report, the rights group Human Rights Watch blames both government troops and separatist fighters for gross human rights violations. It says Cameroonian security forces respond to increasing attacks by armed separatist groups by burning hundreds of homes and other property in villages and cities across the northwest and southwest regions and torture suspected separatists in detention. It also accuses armed separatist groups of killing, torture, assault, and kidnapping dozens of people, including students, teachers, members of the clergy, and administrative and traditional authorities. Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to split the English-speaking Northwest and Southwest from the rest of the country and its French-speaking majority. The secessionist uprising in the English-speaking regions, home to an estimated 7 million people, has cost more than 3,000 lives and forced 500,000 to flee either to the French-speaking regions or into neighboring Nigeria, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The main opposition Malawian Congress Party, or MCP, has begun strategizing for the upcoming August presidential election rerun. Secretary General Eisenhower Mkaka says the group plans to thwart any effort to undermine the integrity of the election. His remarks come after the Constitutional Court annulled the outcome of last year's presidential election. It also ordered an election to be organized within 150 days from the day of the judgment. For more about the opposition party's preparation ahead of the poll, I reach Eisenhower Mkaka, Secretary General of the MCP.
We are ready for takeoff. I think at the moment we are taxing. Basically, what we are doing is to focus on the soft issues, planning, strategizing, and things of that nature, just to make sure that we fill all the loopholes that were used for rigging during the May 21st, 2019 election.
Is the party concerned that a commissioner of the Malawi Electoral Commission stating during a parliamentary hearing that they have yet to begin official preparation to organize the election as ordered by the Constitutional Court? What is your reaction to that?
Peter, what you need to understand that these elections are coming about as a result of a court order. So if we respect the rule of law, we should conduct elections or the presidential election within the time that the court has directed that this election should be conducted. So whether they have started preparations or what, I don't know what magic they would do in order for them to make sure that they comply with the court order. But the point is, the court order must be obeyed.
There are some concerns expressed in Malawi that your recent statement at a campaign could plunge the country into chaos and anarchy, and that there's only one president, legitimate president in Malawi, following the ruling of the Constitutional Court, and that is Professor Peter Arthur Mutharika as the president of Malawi. How do you respond to such criticisms that your statement could create chaos?
What the Malawi Electoral Commission did in May 2019 is what could have plunged this country into chaos. You see, defeating the will of the people and imposing somebody that the people did not want is the only thing that could have plunged this country into chaos. My statement was basically saying, had it not been for TPEX, as we are talking, Chakwera should have been the president of this country. Basically, that's what I was saying. And there is nothing wrong, nothing sinister in that statement, because it is true. We provided evidence in court, and the court agreed with the evidence that we've provided. So if you've noticed, from the time the court pronounced its judgment, there has been peace in this country. Unprecedented, I mean, since the time we had the elections. You can testify that we've witnessed demonstrations, violence, and things of that nature. But ever since the court pronounced their judgment, there has been peace in this country. So I doubt that my statement would in any way plunge this country into any chaos.
HRDC, a political pressure group, has demanded the resignation of Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission, as well as all the commissioners. What is your party's reaction to that? Is that the same stance you are taking?
Exactly the stance that we are taking. Actually, their resignation is long overdue. They didn't need to be told. They didn't need to be pressured by anybody. As a matter of fact, Dr. Jane Ansah is on record to have said that she would resign if the court found that she missed the May 20 presidential election. Now, the court did just that. And I mean, if she has morality, she should, on her own accord, resign without receiving any pressure from anybody, because that's exactly what she said.
But she says she is going to retire. So why not allow the process to work itself out, particularly when Parliament, as ordered by the Constitutional Court, is investigating to find out what happened during the last election?
Peter, we are talking about two different things here. We are talking about her as a justice of appeal and her as the chairperson of the commission. She is going to resign, or she is retiring as justice of appeal. That has got nothing to do with her chairmanship or chairpersonship of the Electoral Commission. So what we are saying is that she has to resign as chair of the Malawi Electoral Commission, regardless of her status as Justice of Appeal. So let her resign, regardless of what of whether she's retiring or not in her career as a Justice of Appeal.
But then it will give the president the opportunity to choose another person as the appointing authority. Are you prepared to accept who the president chooses as the next chairperson or commissioners of the Electoral Commission?
The Constitution does not say that the president has to appoint the chairperson. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that the court has ordered. The court has said Parliament needs to clarify as to who should appoint the chairperson of the commission. Now, you see, the president is conflicted. As long as he becomes the presidential candidate, he becomes conflicted. So I believe that Parliament will do the right thing to make sure that the chairperson of the commission is not appointed by the president, so that we are all put on equal footing.
Eisenhower Mkaka is the Secretary General of the Malawi Congress Party, MCP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, and the National Democratic Congress, or NDC, plan to file a joint petition in court to challenge the outcome of last week's by-election. The two opposition groups say they have evidence to prove the Chilubi parliamentary by-election was marred by irregularities and rigging, an accusation the ruling party rejects as unfounded. Batishimba Kambwili, leader of the National Democratic Congress, or NDC, tells me preliminary results are strong indications that the poll was rigged.
Indeed, it was rigged, and the playing field was not leveled. What actually transpired is that Chilubi is divided into three parts, the island, the mainland, and the swamps. In these areas, you can only access using either speedboats or a ferry. The opposition was not allowed to use the ferry. On the island, which is in some instances, the distance are about 120 kilometers. These areas we never even reached as opposition because we were not allowed to transport the vehicles from the mainland to the island for us to use during elections. And on the day of elections, most of the polling stations were only manned by PF, the police, and the Electoral Commission of Zambia. And when you look at the trends, it has always been a trend in Zambia that on an average, during a by-election, the turnout is usually down by about 35% on an average. But on this one, in a rural area, during the farming season, the difference in votes between 2016 and this year's vote was that only 1,060 people didn't vote. How possible is it? So those figures were just cooked at the polling station.
So, Mr. Kambwili, yes. Is your party going to legally challenge the outcome of the by-election?
Yes, we are going to court. Both the UPND and ourselves are going to court. Because if we don't stop these things, there will be no credible elections in Zambia. The PF must be ashamed of themselves. The last 6 days, they chased all the opposition leaders from Chilubi and only left President Edgar Lungu, who had a total of 9 public rallies. For instance, ourselves and UPND. UPND had one meeting in the entire constituency. So this is not an election where somebody can say they are the victor. It's crookedness of the worst kind at play.
But what do you say to those who say that you knew that the by-elections were coming, you had ample time to prepare and to campaign for your candidate? However, blaming the PF.
Time, my brother, we are only allowed to hold public rallies during the campaign period. And the campaign period was 3 weeks. So PF knocked off 1 week to give to their president, leaving the opposition with only 3 weeks. But you know that what happens during the elections, first you start with organizing the structures before, and then in the last week you hold public rallies to explain to the people why they should vote for you. We were not accorded that opportunity. So how do they say that we had ample time to campaign? We were not given ample time to campaign. Usually the campaign period in a by-election is about 1.5 months. This one, they squeezed it only to 3 weeks.
Do you have proof to back up your claim that the election was rigged?
We have a lot of proof, and that's why we are going to court. We cannot go to court if we don't have the proof. We have the proof. That's why we are going to court.
So are you teaming up with UPND, or are you going independently of each other, challenging the outcome of the election you said is rigged?
No, we are going to challenge collectively. We are not going to challenge individually. We are going to swear in one affidavit, but signed by both the Secretary General of the two political parties.
What do you say to supporters of PF who are saying this is yet another incident where the opposition lost and they are claiming foul play?
You see, the victory of the PF in Chilubi can only be described as like the emperor's new suit, where people are pretending that they were seeing the emperor dressed when in actual fact he was not dressed. PF knows that they can't win an election without malpractice, because they've lost so much respect and popularity. They were giving millimu, almost all the household in Chilubi was given millimu. So you can see that there was a lot of corruption, giving money 20 kwachas, 30 kwachas, and giving millimu. There was so debt in this election that openly debt.
So what's next for your party, the NDC?
It's to go to
to court and we continue mobilizing. But I'm sure you know that we are all not allowed to mobilize. When our members of the meeting outside the elections are arrested, we are not given police permit to mobilize. It's only the PF that continues mobilizing their party throughout the year. The opposition are refused permits to hold even public rallies or even indoor meetings. So what is happening in Zambia needs a lot of intervention from UN, African Union, and of course SADC.
Tshishimba Kambwili is the leader of the Zambian opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, NDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpunga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, Egypt's Zamalek outclassed Tunisia's Esperance 3-1 to win the Africa Super Cup in Doha on Friday, thanks to a brace from Achraf Benkaki. It was the fourth time in Zamalek's history that they lifted the trophy, as the African Confederation Cup holders overpowered the current African Champions League winners. The result is a major boost to Zamalek, who face Esperance again in a fortnight in the Champions League quarterfinals. Friday's fixture helped to draw a line under the chaotic clash that saw Esperance win the African Champions League last season after Wydad Casablanca abandoned the final in protest at the organizers' decision not to use VAR. The Super Cup is an annual one-off match and was staged in Africa from its inception in 1993 until last year when it moved to Qatar. Meanwhile, Morocco became the first African country to use VAR in top-flight league games. The video assistant referee, VAR technology, was used at the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt from the quarterfinals onwards. But history was made in Morocco again on Friday, when VAR was used in a top-flight league game for the first time in Africa. VAR had already made its debut in the Moroccan Cup semifinals and final, but on Friday it featured in IRT Tangier's 2-1 win over FUS Rabat in the league. The use of VAR was set to start at the beginning of the league season, but was delayed in order to give the Moroccan Football Federation a time to train referees and obtain the video refereeing licenses. During the past few months, Moroccan referees have taken part in a variety of training courses to use the technology, whether as main referees or at the video hall. In addition to the training sessions for referees, the Arbitration Directorate also worked on preparing the national stadiums to fulfill the criteria to use VAR technology. In athletics, Uganda's world 10,000 meters champion Joshua Kiptegei has broken the 5-kilometer road world record by 27 seconds in Monaco. The 23-year-old ran 12 minutes 51 seconds, smashed the previous record set by Kenya's Rones Kipruto en route to victory at January's Valencia 10,000 kilometers. Running alone from the start, the Ugandan smashed through the event's 13-minute barrier, clipping a massive 27 seconds from the previous record. France Jimmy Gessia finished second in Monaco with the European record of 13.18. Nick Golab finished third in a new British record of 13.27. The Belgrave Harrier bettering the mark held by Mo Farah and Rob Denmark by 3 seconds. In December, Cheptegei ran 26.38 to break the 10-kilometer road world record, which had stood for almost 10 years. But that mark was bettered last month by Kipruto, who set new records at both 5 kilometers and 10 kilometers in his victory over the latter distance in Spain. Cheptegei's record-breaking time is subject to official World Athletics ratification procedures, as are Kipruto's. The Ugandan beat the most recently ratified 5-kilometer record of 13.22, set by Robert Keita in Lille on November 9th, and also the fastest time ever recorded for the distance, Sami Kipketer's 13 minutes in Carlsbad, USA in 2000. The 5-kilometer only became an official world record event in November of 2017. Finally, in boxing, the much-anticipated rematch between Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder is on Saturday, February 22nd, at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas. The hard-punching Wilder and sleek boxing Fury battled to a memorable draw in November 2018. Their much-anticipated rematch will feature both fighters and defeated records on the line, along with Wilder's WBC belt and Fury's linear title. Fury, with a record of 29 wins, no losses, one draw, with 20 of those wins coming by way of knockout, first won the heavyweight champion with a unanimous decision over long reigning champion Vladimir Klitschko in November 2015. Wilder, with a record of 42 wins, one draw, and 41 of those wins coming by way of knockout, is an undefeated heavyweight champion with a 95% knockout rate. And that's about it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline, Africa Sports. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, there were great excitements and chatting among members of NGOs associated with human rights and humanitarian rights, as well as transitional justice, on the hope that the time was coming when Omar al-Bashir of Sudan will be transferred to The Hague to stand for charges against genocide and war crimes. This has been the biggest trophy that was desired not only by the criminal court in The Hague, but all of these NGOs. For over a decade and a half, when a warrant was issued for the arrest of then President Omar Bashir for these crimes in the war in Darfur, there's been tremendous campaign all over the world, particularly in Africa, that African states should arrest Omar Bashir and send him to The Hague. The chattering and excitement relate to negotiations between the new government in Khartoum and the rebels in Darfur. It has been the consistent demand of the rebels that any solution of the problem should end with sending Omar Bashir to The Hague. The question of sending Omar Bashir to The Hague has caused difficulties between many African states and the International Criminal Court. When the first arrest warrant was issued, heads of state of the African Union appealed to the criminal court to defer the warrant of arrest until al-Bashir leaves office. That was rejected out of hand. We now know that one of the greatest democracies in the world, the United States, has a memorandum in the Justice Department of the U.S. which says no sitting president should be indicted while president, or that he or she should be indicted once he or she leaves office. So after all, the Africans were not that silly. The next issue which the African states have raised is, why is it that the criminal court has focused so inordinately on Africa? Most of the cases which they have dealt with have been Africans. They have dragged the president of Kenya and the deputy to The Hague. They have tried the former president of La Côte d'Ivoire, Gbagbo, to The Hague. They have dragged prominent politicians in the DRC to The Hague. And Africans have said, are only Africans the criminals who are violating the laws of war and committing genocide? This has been a sore problem for many Africans in their dealing with the criminal courts. So now that Omar Bashir has left office and now in prison, what the African Health was calling for is finished. He's no longer president. So now it is a relation between the government of Sudan and the criminal court. But there's one point more to be considered, which shows you the imbalance in relations in the international community. When there were rumors and chattering that U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan and Israeli officials may be called before the ICC for crimes of war either in Afghanistan or in the West Bank or in Gaza, Secretary of State Pompeo quickly laid down the law. Like Sudan, the United States is not a member of the criminal court. But they have seen that this is not a bar. So the U.S. made it clear that any attempt by the criminal court to indict any of its national or that of a principal ally and naming Israel will result in punishment of the criminal courts. And it will begin by denying all visas by members of the criminal court to the United States. Now, those NGOs who are pressing for Bashir to be never made any noise about that. They accepted it as a natural thing for the United States to say, we don't do that. So these are the considerations which Africans have to face. Now, there's yet no clear decision as to whether the sovereign government of Sudan will send Bashir to The Hague. It has been reported there should be more discussions between the criminal court and the government. But even if in the end Bashir is sent to The Hague, no African should be surprised, because this is the nature of the world. And the reason being that the criminal court cannot mess with powerful states, because their nose will be bloodied. But they can mess with weak states, like African states. And furthermore, Africans should remember that the African continent is seen as the sick man of the international community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And hearing from Wizkid on top, Your Mata Rima follows with Touch My Body, and then Mbusu ends it with Majab.
Chanukia, uturi kajifisha Vidore nasimamia, ukingoni nafikishwa Nani kosha mwili kwa maji ya madafu Yeno kocha, nana nifunza kucheza rafu Anichua tumbo langiri kwa mafuta ya karafu Nikichoka, nana nikanda kwa mabarafu Zila kila jam, majab, majab, mahaba ya kila jam, majab, majab. Zila kila jam, majab, majab, mahaba ya kila jam. Kifuanu ni paka harua, mikono tende anazi chambua. Anilamba Kitandani humwaga maua Mingine hata chembe siku anajua Antoa ushamba Nalitake nini kwake Nyombe sipewe Iwe pemba machake chake Chagwe mwenyewe Kanipapo mero yake Ninywe nilewe Mambo shegani mwake mwake Mangaka msewe Libandike Penzi kama gazeti Walisome Tuadabishe Sangara shombo vipweti Tuamone Nikila nilishe Chapati za alizeti Ninone Tuafungishe Midomo uzi simenti Tuashone Nani kosha mwili Kwa maji ya madafu Yeno kocha
ananifunza kucheza rafu anijua tumbo la ngiri kwa mafuta ya karafu nikichoka ananitanda kwa mabarafu majabu majabu penzi lake la ajabu majabu majabu mahaba yake ya ajabu majabu majabu penzi lake la ajabu.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, fire and gunpowder do not sleep together. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel.